So I'm gonna take advantage of a Friday as followed by a Saturday and a Sunday. So I would like to grade the things on Monday and get it in. So that way I only get a nasty email saying, you're a day late, as opposed to, you're a month late. And somebody already submitted their extra credit, but I'm not gonna mention any names, Rama. Good job, thank you. All right, well, everyone decides they're too good to come to class. Well, I got lots of red dots today, and that's fine. All right, so we got to finish up. As you should have gotten an email notification, because I did it yesterday afternoon. I programmed in your exam. Like I mentioned on Tuesday, you have until Sunday night at 11:59 to get it done. It will open tonight at 6, I think.
I think I did 6 o'clock.
So you have ample time to get where you need to go if you're going somewhere for spring break, and then you can just bang it out when you get there. Right. Or you could do it tonight if you're not leaving until tomorrow. And it will cover, it's not a cumulative exam, it will cover everything that we've covered since after exam one. So we started with the Renaissance and we went forward with that. Morning, Joe. All right, so we just got to finish up what England and France was doing in the New World, because they were building mercantilist empires as well. They were motivated for the same reasons that the Portuguese and the Spanish were motivated, particularly during the reign of Henry VII. He wanted more, more, more. And he, similar to the Spanish and the Portuguese, initially was trying to get to Asia. But of course, a whole bunch of expeditions were sent out and they discovered what today we call North America, but they didn't quite know what was there. Although by Sebastian Cabot's exploration, it was kind of clear that they weren't in Asia, that there was this massive landmass. So really the focus was on how the heck to get around it. Because again, the goal was to get to Asia. When Henry VIII became king, and we'll talk about him after break, he did not share his father's desire in terms of westward exploration, because he was occupied with implementing a Protestant Reformation in his country, breaking England away from the church, all motivated by his desire to have a son. And interestingly enough, his immediate successors, his son Edward VI, his daughter Mary, none of them, even during the beginning of Elizabeth's reign, none of the Tudor monarchs really were interested in exploiting what Cabot and others had discovered. Instead, they focused on what technically is referred to as interloping, and of course trying to cut into the slave trade, because the Spaniards, and then once the Portuguese began to settle Brazil, they were paying big bucks. So just like the Portuguese motivated to carry the Asian goods and the Asian trade network, the English realized they could make more money transporting the slaves from Africa to the New World than they could developing colonies. But I'm going to circle back to the word interloping first. Anyone have any idea what that word means? Interloping? If you interlope, you cut in. You cut into. So imagine for me this. You have the vast Atlantic Ocean, and you have these slow, hulking Spanish galleons full of tons of cargo. There's no GPS, there's no sat phones or cellular technology. How likely do you think a ship could just disappear in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean? Well, very likely. They're wooden boxes, and it doesn't take much for them to go. So if a ship was reported to be sailing across and never arrive It's no big deal. Well, here's the funny thing. What the tutors were doing is they were giving English ship captains licenses to engage in what today we call piracy. Because the English ships were faster and more maneuverable. So what the English began doing is intercepting the Spanish ships, boarding them, killing the crew, and then just sailing the ships to England, full of tons of rich cargo. And of course, all of us are intelligent enough to realize that stealing something usually involves very little to no overhead, right? So for about 70 years, the English really didn't do anything with the New World. And it really wasn't an issue. But during the reign of Elizabeth I, the last of the Tudor monarchs, things started changing. As early as the 1570s, debate began in Parliament, which began to stir the imaginations of the well-to-do about the riches that were being transported back from Asia by the Portuguese. So, that being the case, parliamentarians started saying, well, we know we have this landmass. Let's see if we can get around it. Because if we can get to China, we can get a taste of that. We know we're not going to go south, because this is now 50, 60 years after Magellan. We know how big the Earth is. We know that there's two continents in the way. And we know that there's no way through, at least from Central America down to South America. Should have the cover on. Good thing it's just water. Down to South America without having to circumnavigate it. So we can't go down there because that's Spanish and Portuguese territory. So the only other opportunity is to go to the north, either going easterly or westerly or easterly. And there was a debate. Which way do we go? Again, they had no idea, FYI, about the Arctic Circle. They knew it got colder as you went up. They know there was more ice flowing, icebergs flowing in the North Atlantic because of the Little Ice Age. But this was building still to what it would reach in terms of its farthest extent. And that would be around 1800 to 1850. What they didn't know is if they could get around north of Russia and end up in China. Or if they could get around today what we call Canada by going that way. Of course, now we know you can't. But there was the debate. So, long story short, one member of Parliament who led the charge trying to discover a northwest passage, a noble by the name of Sir Humphrey Gilbert, decided to pay out of his own pocket for an expedition to discover a northwest passage. Now, of course, in order to do so, he had to get the permission from the Queen, and he received a charter. But again, the Queen would not get a cut because the Queen did not pay. This was the beginning of a new trend in England where the explorers would pay and thus they would reap the rewards of profit. Now, Gilbert traveled across the Atlantic Ocean following, generally speaking, the same paths as those explorers who went 70 years before. And he arrived on Newfoundland, Newfoundland, and much to his shock, he discovered that there were people there. There were Portuguese, There were French. There were Spaniards. There were Irish. There were even English. And they had established a small little town called St. John's. Well, here's the amazing thing. St. John's was used as a spot by these captains to not only get fresh water, not only to harvest wood to make repairs, but these men coming across were fishermen, private individuals, and they were doing it without the knowledge of their government. Now, FYI, I'm going to throw this out there. This is the reason why the North American Indian population diminished significantly. Because just like the Spaniards were bringing across disease to Central and South America, these fishermen, Irish, English, Scottish, French, Portuguese, they too were bringing diseases. And so, for instance, when the people we call pilgrims arrived on Cape Cod, they actually took up residence in a Patuxet village that had been completely depopulated because all the people died of smallpox. Now, did they know they were doing this? No. But again, that's the reason why when the English started making colonies, it was so easy to take control of the Atlantic coast, because there were few Indians actually here. It was just open land. But again, it all traces its origins back to this unrecorded period of about 70 odd years when all of these entrepreneurs braved the trip to fish. Because remember, Sebastian Cabot reported the abundance of fish. Well, Gilbert arrives, and he basically declares, England claimed this. It was claimed for God and country. So he would take possession of St. John's. Kicked out all the non-English. And basically established an English position. Well, he then travels the coastline and made a huge discovery. This region out here is called the Grand Banks. The Grand Banks, even today, after hundreds of years of fishing, is one of the richest populations or centers on Earth for fish. It just teems with life. So Gilbert made note of it, recorded the coordinates, but then he sold it. He claimed in his records that the fish in this region were so plentiful that it would be possible for a man to jump off of his ship and walk on the backs of the fish all the way to the shore. Unfortunately, on his return trip, his ship, the Squirrel, which was the smallest of the three vessels in his fleet, if you call it that, got stuck in a storm, and the ship literally did one of the main support beams cracked in the waves. He was actually advised by the other ship captains to abandon ship. But do captains abandon their ship? No, he would actually go down to Davy Jones' locker. And according to the accounts of the men who left his ship and one of the others, he was last seen sitting on the deck of the Squirrel reading his favorite book. But His crew came back, the other two ships, reported what was discovered, and this would spark the imaginations of others to come. One of the first leading explorers to follow on Gilbert's footsteps, trying to find something here, was his half-brother, Sir Walter Raleigh. He might be a name that you've heard of. Yeah, no? Well, he was a man's man. He was maybe not a household name, but he was well known in England. He was the equivalent of somebody like maybe not like a Tom Brady, but he all Tom Brady did was play games. And you can't say like an actor, because actors are just wannabe, you know, pretend people. Trying to think of somebody that's actually accomplished something real that you may know of. I'm drawing a blank. How about Leon Trudell? Not Trudell. What the heck is the lone sniper's name? No?
Chris Kyle.
Chris Kyle. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Who the heck is... Oh, that's one of his partners. I can't remember his name. Whatever. I'm a brain fart, but yeah. So, we have to give somebody who actually does something. Athletes, they don't do anything. They just play little kid games. And actors, they just do the same thing that we all did when we were 5 or 6. You know, they just do make-believe. But this guy actually did stuff. He was a swashbuckling adventurer. He fought in France in the wars of religion that we're going to talk about. He took part in suppressing an Irish uprising. And his accomplishments made him famous. It's also said that Queen Elizabeth kind of had the hots for him. So, in 1584, the Queen would grant to Raleigh a charter. Want you to get these details down. Raleigh's charter was different and would be significant, because Raleigh's charter ultimately is what would lead to the foundation of the American colonies. Term number one. He was to explore and colonize. Tell me if you've heard this phrase before. Any, and I quote, remote, heathen, and barbarous lands not actually possessed by any Christian prince, nor inhabited by Christian people. 1584. This is the same mindset of terra nullius, no one's land. He could explore and colonize, take possession of any lands not possessed by Christians. Term number two. If he establishes a colony, he personally is going to receive 20% of any gold and silver discovered. Term number two, Raleigh will receive 20% of any gold or any silver discovered. So again, juxtapose that against the terms that the Portuguese kings were giving, where the crown basically paid for everything, so the crown would get that cut. Well, he's paying for it out of his own pocket. But the deal was he personally could become fabulously wealthy. And here's the last one, term number three. He had 7 years to do so. So he would have a monopoly. No one else would have the right to come over and colonize North America. It would just be Raleigh. But after 7 years, the Queen had the right to give other charters. So, why did Elizabeth do this? Well, part of it was because she wanted to start making money. Elizabeth started thinking more, more, more. If we could take possession of more land, we might be able to generate wealth, which of course would make me richer and more powerful. But the other part is also kind of funny. Any North American colony was supposed to be a base for pirates, a base of operations for English privateers. Questions? But again, I want to go back, I want to circle back to the point I just made. I really want to hit it home. This was England completely changing the way exploration would be made. The risk would be taken by private individuals. Thus, the profit would go to the private individuals, and the crown would benefit indirectly by those resources going to the mother country and being taxed on entry and export. All right. During a 7-year period, Raleigh would launch 3 expeditions. The first was exploring the coastline, utilizing the map, the rough map made by Sebastian Cabot. This first expedition would go over, of course, check on the status of St. John's, and would sail roughly from Newfoundland all the way down the North American coast, looking for a good spot. Well, Raleigh, during this expedition, decided to name the English possession, which again stretches from about Newfoundland, Newfoundland out here, all the way down to the Chesapeake Bay. He named it after the Virgin King. He called the whole swath Virginia. Then his second expedition came over, after the first found an ideal location right here, the Chesapeake Bay. According to the account from the first expedition, this was a perfect location to establish a base because you had these large sandbars which stretched out into the ocean and provided natural barriers from the storms. And there were a few wide entry points that could be easily defended. And the waterway was deep enough that ocean-going vessels could, if need be, sail inland and get further protection. So, they found their spot. The second expedition would be an attempt to build a colony. 1585, on Roanoke Island, a settlement was made. Now, Raleigh told them, see if you can find gold and silver, because obviously he wanted to get rich, and see if any of these inlets are the Northwest Passage. Unfortunately for the men that were there, they found neither. And to make matters worse, any attempt to penetrate met Indian resistance. So after several months, the men became frustrated. Fortunately for those guys, 1586, another famous English privateer, a man by the name of Sir Francis Drake, who, by the way, Sir Francis Drake, any of you know that name? Drake's cakes were not named after him. But Sir Francis Drake was the first English captain to discover Magellan's way around South America. Which is kind of funny. Any of you watch Shogun on Tuesday night? You should watch Shogun. It's on Hulu. You can watch the first two episodes. So much of what I talked about in terms of the exploitation of the Asian trade network, it's all covered there. Good, good, good series. I'm enjoying it thoroughly. But in Shogun, they gave reference to the fact that the Spanish and then later the Portuguese basically kept Magellan's path secret from the world. So nobody knew how exactly to get around South America. But Drake was the first one to actually do it. He sailed all the way up to South America, and he would actually plant a claim for England as far north as modern California. Just FYI. But anyways, Drake arrives in Roanoke, and the guys are like, these Indians are crazy. There's nothing of value here. We have little food. Take us home. So they abandon the first colony. But Raleigh, knowing he was running out of time, would try again. Because that's what we do if we don't succeed the first time, right? Try again. So in 1587, he would send his third and final expedition to the New World with the goal of establishing a colony which he himself, because he had a big ego, would name after himself. He'd call it Raleigh City. Raleigh City, instead of being located on Roanoke Island, would be built inland. And I show you this picture because originally the location was to be secret. So on the original map, this is where it would be located. But they used invisible ink. So that way, if any Spaniards or Portuguese got the location, they wouldn't know where it was. This expedition, however, would be different than the second. Raleigh realized one of the reasons why the second group failed, or the first colony failed, was because the men didn't do the important stuff. The men spent all their time trying to find gold and silver. They didn't make adequate shelter. They didn't engage in agriculture. So as a consequence, that's one of the reasons why they were starving and they were cold. So what's the best way to get a man to actually do things necessary for survival? I have five ladies in here. Any of you know? How do you get a man to do something responsible? You send women. Duh. So, this time, instead of sending over just men, Raleigh allowed women and children to sail over. Because a husband is going to protect his wife at all costs. And he's not going to spend all his time gallivanting, trying to find gold and silver. This expedition would be made up of 118 colonists. 90 were men, but 17 were women, and there were 9 children. So, Raleigh hoped that this would become a permanent settlement because the husbands would want to build nice houses and would spend time raising food to take care of their wives and their kids. Which, of course, makes what the English did very different than what the Portuguese were doing or the Spaniards. Not only did women and children came, but a baby was born over here. The first English child, or I'll use modern politically correct language, the first child of English descent, Virginia Dare, was born here. I couldn't imagine going across the Atlantic Ocean in the 1500s in a wooden box while pregnant. But his mother did. Her mother did, rather. They would make their settlement. They would actually engage in several skirmishes with the natives. But essentially, they would plant what was perceived to be a permanent settlement. It had a stockade. There were permanent structures built in there. They managed to give themselves an area of high ground so you could engage in some farming close to the walls. They were ready to go. But summertime was ending because they arrived in July. By the end of August, the ships were preparing to go back to get more supplies, to get more colonists. The lead negotiator for this attempt to get more men, more stuff, more women, was the captain, the leader of the expedition, John White. Of course, interestingly enough, John White was Virginia's grandfather. So imagine this guy leaving his daughter and his granddaughter, getting on a ship, going back across the Atlantic. Now, of course, White was optimistic that he could accomplish this because, again, Raleigh still had 3 years. So his plan was just to go to Raleigh and basically say, hey, look, we need more, give me more, and we'll make you more money. But timing is everything. Unfortunately for White, when he returned to England, there was a state of war on. The Spanish king, Philip II, had declared war on Elizabeth in England. And he launched a massive fleet, which today we call the Spanish Armada, with the attempt or intent to land in England and conquer it. We'll talk more about that when we do the Wars of Religion after break. But long story short, White would have to wait 2.5 years before he was able to go back because all of the ships were seized by the crown to use for the defense of the island. When he returned in August 1590, much to his horror, Roanoke Island, which is where he stopped first, which was to be the retreat point, no one was there. So he continued onward to the location of Raleigh City. Upon his arrival, he noticed the palisade was still there, the wall. So he and his men offloaded, climbed up the hill, and entered the city. But when they entered, the gate was open, it was not defended, and all of the buildings had been taken apart and left in neat stacks. There was no signs of violence. There were no mass graves. There was no burned embers. It literally looked like the people just simply got up and left. But there was no record, no word, no letter, nothing saying where they went. Except for one clue. One clue.
That's not going to write. There's some of that invisible ink that I was alluding to.
Carved into one of the posts near the gate was this word, Croatoan. Croatoan. Here's the catch. Croatoan was the name that the English gave to one of the tribes. Croatoan was also the name that the tribes had for this place. And Croatoan was also a reference to Roanoke Island in particular. What did this mean? Don't know. White and his men searched the area for weeks and found no sign. To this day, nobody knows what happened to these people, which is one of the reasons why it's known as the Lost Colony of Rome. Well, these expeditions ultimately would bankrupt Raleigh, and for the next 20 years, once again, the English pretty much decided that the idea of making money in North America was going nowhere. There was an ongoing war with Spain. There was lacking of financial resources. And after these experiences, the unrealistic cities of gold, like existed in Central and South America, didn't appear to be true. So pretty much everyone was done. That was until the early 1600s. During the reign of the first Stuart king, James I. When James came to the throne, all of the problems that existed during Elizabeth's reign, particularly the war with Spain, came to an end. So conditions were more ripe. But as king, he didn't have the money to start this up again. But he allowed the formation of what today we call joint stock trading companies, who would do the colonizing. This is like any corporation today that offers stock on the stock market. These companies would raise money by offering a percentage of ownership in the company to investors. So you could go in and buy 10 shares of stock. And if the company makes money, you get a percentage of the profits. So this suddenly meant, instead of having one guy like Gilbert or one guy like Raleigh taking all the risk, now you could have hundreds of people. And some of these companies would use the funds to fund ventures. The crown approved, because if the company failed, the king doesn't care. King loses no money. But if the company's successful, again, he could tax everything coming in. So this would allow the crown to regulate it and make sure it's serving the interest of the mercantile empire. So the initial colonies were all about making money. Business. Business. Now, the first attempt by these joint stock trading companies actually failed. The first one was up in Maine. But shortly on the heels of the failure in Maine, which I think collapsed in 1605, they would again tempt further south. But ultimately, this would allow for the foundation of a colony that would become Jamestown, obviously named in honor of the king. Then 13 years later, that should be 1620, not 162. I keep saying it, I've been doing this, I've had this slide for like 5 years, and every time it comes up, I'm like, oh yeah, I gotta fix it, but I always forget. But 1620, Plymouth was founded. But again, both were the same. FYI, we know Plymouth had the Pilgrims in it, but the funding for that expedition was a business arrangement. So the colonists had to come here and make goods. Now, first and foremost, these colonies would be deemed company property. Company property. So, if you got on a boat and you came across and you lived here, to a degree, you were an employee of the company. Your job was to produce something of value. Something that could be put on a boat and shipped back to England. That would be sold by the company. Now, luckily, the colonists in both companies found things to exploit. Tobacco would be introduced in Jamestown and would make the London Company more money than you can imagine. Plymouth was a little different. The colonists in Plymouth worked their butts off and would end up buying the property from the company. But they exploited cod, fur, and timber. But the interesting thing about this development is that the people over here, or rather over here, you would never see the rise of nobility. Because over in North America, your last name didn't matter. You became rich by your own hands. Who could come? Well, there were two types of people who came. There were the freemen who paid their own way. And then there were the indentured servants. People who didn't have the money to come over, but basically signed a contract and promised to work for a landowner for a certain amount of years. 3, 5, 7, 10, I've read all different types.
Hi, I'm from IT, I just need to grab something real quick.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Could you also get a battery too?
I didn't even notice, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
that'd be great. You mind if I just keep going?
Yeah.
All right.
I'll just be a second.
Yep. Are you going to unplug me?
No, just this.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, so indentured servants. One other thing that I should mention, and as a history professor, it's one of the things that hurts me about revisionism that occurs in scholarship today where they're trying to rewrite history, one of the things that really hurt me really bad is that 1620 project. FYI, the first Africans that came over to Jamestown, they were not slaves. They were originally indentured servants. They were contracted to work for a certain amount of years, and once they were done, they were freed. Just FYI. All right, so you have the people that were given right by the company to take possession of land, and then, of course, you had the people who worked for them. But interestingly enough, when the indentured servants were done, they were allowed to take possession of land. They were given land by the company. So they could become freemen. Another interesting thing about the American colonies, both at Jamestown and Plymouth, as well as all of the other colonies that would be established, women came over. Unlike the Spaniards, who were forced to couple with natives because there were no Spanish women, and the same thing happened in the places where Portugal went. In America, the English brought over English women. And this allowed them to experience what Ben Franklin talked about 150 years later. He referred to it as the American multiplication system. FYI, in 1630, by 1630, Massachusetts would be founded. There would be three colonies over here that had a total population of 10,000. But when Ben Franklin wrote about it in 1763, there were 14 colonies, and it had a population of 3 million. Had nothing to do with immigration. It was all about nature. When a man and a woman get together, they make babies. Another feature that was very different than the Spanish, who considered all of the New World as the property of the king. Same thing in Portugal. All of the forts, or whatever they made those ports, they were all considered to be property of the king. In England, no. Once the colonies were established, for the most part, the local people here could pretty much do whatever they wanted. They were semi-autonomous. They had charters that allowed them to set up local governments. There were elections. There were local assemblies and colonial assemblies. And the colonists themselves could basically vote and make the rules that they wanted for their colonies. It was bottom up, unlike in Spain, where everything was top down. And these assemblies could make laws that applied to all of the people in the colony. To get on, you had to run, and people voted. And lastly, everything was written down. The English, unlike anyone else on earth, believed in the importance of writing constitutions. The purpose of a constitution, although they were called charters, but the purpose of a colonial charter was to make the rules under which the government could operate. They also embraced common law, which was native only to England. The English came up with the idea, and again, it goes back to Magna Carta, which we talked about, is that even the king has to follow the law. The law applies to everyone in common. And lastly, they believed that free people had rights. They were entitled to property rights, speech rights, assembly rights, which makes them unique, very different than what was being created elsewhere on earth. In FYI, this right here would serve as the foundation upon which America was built. And that's why the United States today is the exception on earth. We are not the rule. We are different here. And it all goes back to our foundation during colonial times. Questions? All right, well, what about the French? Because the French came over too.
But the French came over last.
Unlike what took place during the reign of Henry VII, who was fascinated by the reports of Columbus, France had a lot of problems going on. So the French really didn't decide to get into the mercantilist game until after Magellan returned, or his crew returned. So it was during the reign of Francis I, who was on the throne in 1522, and he decides he wants to get into the mercantilism game. And of course, the reasons are the same. Why? He wanted more, more, more. So, similar to what occurred in England, he would grant a commission to an Italian explorer, Giovanni de Verrazzano, who would set sail across the Atlantic and explore. Now, FYI, to keep things in perspective, 1522, we're now 15 years after Sebastian Cabot came back and after the death of Henry VII. As I mentioned, England was not interested. Do you know what happens to your land, your home, if you abandon it? Squatters can come in. If you don't maintain possession of your land, someone else can take possession of it. So because England wasn't doing anything, the French said, well, we'll give it a shot. So his mission, pretty straightforward, was to find this newfound land that the explorers sailing under the flag of England had discovered. Unfortunately, in his path across, he was blown off course. His intent was to go this way, but he ended up going south. And interestingly enough, he came across the Atlantic coast down around the point at the southern point of the Chesapeake Bay, Cape Fear, North Carolina. But for the next few months, he sailed north, and again, he drew his map. He actually would attempt to penetrate New York Bay. He tried going up the Hudson River. That didn't work. Then he came back. On his map, he actually made reference to Cape Cod in the islands. Then attempted to penetrate again, looking for that Northwest Passage. Went up the Sendahawk River, which, if you've ever gone to the Kittery Outlets, when you go over that bridge, when you go by Portsmouth, New Hampshire, that's the Sendahawk River. And he continued going all the way up beyond Nova Scotia, Cape Breton, and then finally touched upon Newfoundland before coming back. He also would plant somewhere in the St. Lawrence River, St. Lawrence Bay here, he also would plant a massive cross said to be 15 feet tall and had painted on it, "Long live the King of France." So, while this loosely was claimed by England, because nobody was here, this region behind here would be claimed in the name of the King of France. Questions? All right. It would take 12 years before the next French explorer came over because Francis found himself at war. But when things settled down, 1534, Francis would commission Jacques Cartier to come over and to find the Northwest Passage. Utilizing Voronzo's map, he would come over, I think the green is his first trip, and he would go around Newfoundland and he would enter the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And he made record of a possible vast deep water entryway into the continent. And he left a star on his map claiming this could potentially be the Northwest Passage. He would come back, and then he would go again. This time, he was determined to penetrate what today we call the St. Lawrence River. Now, the focus of this trip was, again, seeing if this was the Northwest Passage. He was going to go through as far as he could get. Unfortunately, he arrived on October 2nd. And what happens in this part of the world, generally speaking, in and around October? Although this was kind of an abnormal winter. What usually happens? It gets cold, it snows, and believe it or not, back then the St. Lawrence River would actually freeze. Although today, it doesn't freeze all the way, but it sometimes becomes impenetrable because there are large chunks of ice floating in the river. Now, when he first arrived, before setting down for the winter, he would penetrate as far down as somewhere in this region near that where that dot is, and he arrived at what at the time was the capital of the Iroquoian nation, Satakana. Satakana is believed to be just a few miles north of the modern city of Quebec. He would actually meet with the chief, a man by the name of Donnacona, and apparently got along swimmingly. Donnacona gave Cartier and his men a blessing to spend the winter with them, which they did. Carter would establish good relations, and ultimately that friendship would allow him and his men to survive the winter. When winter ended, he would get back in his ships, and he would go back. Fast forward 5 years down the road, 1541. He would set forth on his last expedition with the goal of establishing a permanent colony. Why? Well, Francis decided he needed it for the resources. Cartier would set sail with multiple ships. He had over 100 men. And the mission was to extract something of value. Anything. Now, FYI, his men would actually dig up 2 shiploads of pyrite. Anyone know what pyrite is? Pyrite? No? Fool's gold?
Oh, is it that?
Yeah. Looks like gold. Kind of feels like gold, but yeah, if you put a little pressure on it, put a little chemical on it, it'll flake, fall apart. But they didn't know. So imagine extracting tons of fool's gold, putting it in the bottom of a boat, saying, hey, we're rich, only to get back to France and realize, oh, it's crap. Fortunately, that would happen to them. Secondly, as his men started penetrating, going into sacred Indian lands, they kind of began rubbing the Iroquois the wrong way. So even though he would establish a semi-permanent base, ultimately the Indians began attacking him, particularly when there was an outbreak of disease reported, smallpox. They brought over with them smallpox. Now again, to reference something I said, some experts believe that once the smallpox affected Canada, it would be the smallpox that would be shared and eventually would make it down in New England and would largely wipe out the native population that was once here. course, making it easier for the English to take over. Well, after the failure of this colony, Francis became angry, he began disgusted, and he basically decided, this is stupid. So he would give up. Now, during the reign of his son, his grandsons, unfortunately, France would be plagued by a series of religious wars, which we're going to talk about, that would result in the deaths of over 1 million people, all in the name of figuring out which church we should follow. But it was during that destruction that, you know, France was not interested either. But the stories of Cartier, in part, are what inspired some of those fishermen that I mentioned to begin taking the risk of going across the Atlantic to fish. It would not be until 1601 when Henri IV, who of course was in competition with King James I of England, who decided to exploit the claims of his predecessors. Why? Henri wanted more, more, more. So, he would make a vital, critical decision. And he would give a commission to Samuel de Champlain. Champlain was the equivalent of Raleigh. He was an alpha male, famous in the French court. He was an adventurer. He had actually traveled to some of the Spanish colonies in the New World. He actually walked the streets of Mexico City and visited many of the Caribbean islands. So he understood the wealth that could be generated by taking possession of land. But before he went, he did something that no one else who had gone before him, or even after, did. He took the time to study. He would spend 3 years reading the accounts of those who went across. He would spend 3 years meeting with some of the fishermen who had made the transatlantic crossing. He also talked to a bunch of French businessmen who actually had been landing in Nova Scotia and in Maine to hunt fur. So he actually talked to the people who was there. Then in 1603, he decided he wanted to see the New World for himself. So he joined one of those fur trapping expeditions. He wanted to see the sites mentioned by Cartier with his own eyes. And during the course of several trips, he came over a whole bunch of times. He met many Indians, and he had opportunity to explore much of this part of the world. He would also, again, as this map references, he would travel from the Gulf of St. Lawrence all the way down to Cape Cod in the years before the Pilgrims came over. It would not be until his third major trip over in 1609, where after much exploration, after much consideration, he would determine the best location for a permanent colony would be in a place the Indians called Quebec, which is Algonquin for where the river narrows. Of course, he called it the habitation. But today, we know it as the city of Quebec. And if you've ever been to Quebec, no trace of the original settlement exists. In the middle of a busy street intersection, there's actually a sign, there's a plaque that says, this is where the habitation was located. I got a chuckle out of it. I took a picture of it. I forgot to put it on here. But anyways, from this base, he envisioned French trappers permeating out into the forests, using connections with Native Americans, Indians, to hunt fur, to bring them to Quebec, put them on ships, and sail them back to the New World. I mean, the Old World. FYI, fur, if you were a fur hunter, you could become richer than any other type of merchant. Fur, if you remember those consumptuary laws that we talked about that were put in place after the plague, fur could only be worn by certain classes of people, mostly the rich. And all of the little furry creatures had been hunted to extinction in Europe as a result of thousands of years of hunting. So the little furry creatures here provided a luxury item that, you know, could be consumed. As business grew and his journeys continued, he would later found the city of Montreal, a little further down south. For the same reason, now we have two bases of operations. He also would explore and he would discover all of the Great Lakes, trying to find this Northwest Passage, only to realize there is none. He would also go back to France. And during the reign of Louis XIII, he was granted a right to establish an official colony. All of this became known as New France, with Champlain serving as the first governor. He would spend the rest of his life, until he died in 1632, making New France profitable for the crown. Questions? All right, well then let's wrap it up. I got the Great Lakes. I already said that. He claimed the Great Lakes as well. In time, as a result of other French explorers, including Joliet, who would discover the northern waters of the Mississippi and would sail south, including La Salle, who would found Louisiana at the mouth of the Louisiana River, Mississippi River, and New Orleans, which would become the primary southern base of operations. Over the course of the next 100 years, more French explorers came, and at its height, all of the stuff in blue, even the dual lines, because that would be co-claimed by the English and the France, would be claimed by France. Two colonies would be made, Louisiana, named after King Louis, and of course New France. But unlike what was growing on the Atlantic coast, these colonies were nothing more than a string of trading posts and fortifications. So these dots would be places where French trappers could go and get resupply, could get more ammunition. These forts would also be relay points for the friendly Indian tribes that would do a lot of the work on behalf of the French. Most of the colonists that lived in these points were either soldiers or they were trappers. But of course, there were many Jesuit priests that came over to try to convert the heathens to the true faith. But, there were few, if any, French women, which meant, sorry, I thought there was no multiplication. I guess they don't have that exact line up there. So you know what this meant? The men had to engage in behavior similar to what the Spaniards did. They had to cohabitat with native women. And this was made possible because the French had no desire to conquer them like the Spanish did. But rather, the French were content to do business with the Indian tribes. But ultimately, that's what allowed this colony to become so vast so far. Because the Indians basically allowed them to come in. They didn't stop them because they knew they weren't a threat. So even though France claimed possession of this, again, they weren't building towns, they weren't building farms. And interestingly enough, even the Jesuits weren't successful in converting many Indians, but it was the Jesuits who thankfully recorded much of the native tribes' culture and preserved it for posterity. But, actually I'm just going to go back to here. But, what eventually would take place and would actually result in war is as the English population, because of the American multiplication system, continued to grow, they would grow into lands held by not only the Indians, but also lands claimed by the French. And ultimately, when you have two people claiming the same things, conflict arises. And of course, I'm sure in high school you studied the French and Indian War. It ultimately would give rise to that conflict. But, again, unlike... Sorry, I thought there was one more click. I guess not. Discard. We'll go back to this. I'll just bring this up. Well, we can. Unlike what the Spanish did, unlike what the Portuguese did, unlike what the English did, ultimately the French colony was of probably the three, the least that you would think of in terms of mercantilism. But again, it goes back to a point that I made, that business is not about race, business is not about religion. At the end of the day, business is just trying to get as many of these bills that you can in your wallet at all times. Because a one with a couple of zeros over it is not a bad thing to have lots of. Questions? All right. So as I mentioned to those people who are here at the start of class, and hopefully the people who are listening, your exam will open up at 6 p.m. tonight. You have until Sunday evening at 11:59 p.m. to complete it. Please, I would suggest you do it sooner than later. And of course, do not forget, because if you do not take the exam, that will be 15% of your grade. That's a zero. The other thing that I'm going to be sending out is an exact attendance update. So that way everyone has a chance to know how many absences they have, so they can understand that if they got more than 4, points are going to come off your final average. But those penalty points will not be applied to the midterm. Those points are only applied to the end. Similarly, if you have perfect attendance, we will also have reference to that. And of course, if you end up at the end of the semester with perfect attendance, then you'll get extra points. All right? If there are any questions, send me an email. If I don't hear from you, again, don't forget the test. I will take extra credit all the way up until Sunday evening at 11:59 p.m. Email those to me. And if you do go away, be safe. Have fun. As I always tell my kids whenever they go away, just don't be dumb. And we'll see you in a week and a half or so, all right? Toodles.